So in this new episode of The Music Folder by Archivio Ricordi, I'm talking to a legend of electronic music, a pioneer in the field of live performance with electronic music instruments, a pioneer of sound design and music composition. It's a great pleasure for me to be here with Suzanne Chiali.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. Thank you.
I wanted to actually start with the performance side of your music practice. Performing live is an integral part of your music practice. But to this day, there is a perception that electronic music is not made for the stage, in the sense that there's even this joke that whoever brings a laptop to a stage, to their setup, it's probably because they're checking their email rather than making music. But much of what you did at the beginning of your career was exactly the opposite. You wanted to prove that electronic instruments had a place in live performances like any other instruments.
Exactly.
Or music.
Yeah. It's all very simple. Yeah. But at the essence of this viewpoint is the fact that I had an instrument. Don Buchla designed, not immediately, you know, Don Buchla started in 1963, and he designed something that could make electronic sound. By the time I met him, which was 5 years later in 1968, his vision had already evolved to the concept of an instrument. He saw it as a performable instrument, and this was very unusual. And therefore, all of his design incorporated the consciousness of live interaction. So he built in a feedback system. There were lights that indicated what was going on. Nobody else was doing this at the time. There were distinctions in the cables and color coding and differentiation between audio signals and control voltages. The control voltage was the mode of, you know, in composition, you are organizing sound. And in this instrument, the control voltages were the tools that allowed you to organize the sound. So you had different voltages, envelopes that could have attacks and decays, sequencers that had strings of notes. And all of these voltages would be used to control the sound. So anyway, the important thing is that from the beginning, it was quadraphonic. He understood that spatial movement was integral to electronic sound. It was basically a monophonic signal. Not very interesting, but you could animate it by moving it in time with the music. It was all integrated. So if I had a rhythm, I could make a spatial rhythm, you know, just by moving the sound. We didn't record very much in quad because we didn't have the tape recorders then. It wasn't normal. So it was very much a live experience. And there are just a few documents from my early days of performing, one from 1974, one from 1975, but they weren't recorded in quadraphonic. Now I'm out performing live in quad.
It seems to me there is still some sort of resistance in the world of classical music when it comes about integrating these instruments. It's very rare to see an orchestra or a classical music ensemble with an element of electronic music integrated both in the performance, in the writing of the piece. Would you say that electronic music is still needs to prove its salt when it comes about being able to perform in such a setting compared to when you started?
You know, there was a piece that Daphne Oram, do you know that piece? from the 1940s.
No, I don't know Duff and Moore.
You do know Duff and Moore? Well, I performed once at Royal Albert Hall, and they premiered, this was a few years ago, and they premiered a piece that she had written in the 40s.
Was it a symphonic piece?
Yes.
Okay.
She was so ahead of her time, so she had two orchestras side by side with a partition in between, and one of the orchestras was being live processed to enhance the musical communication. You know, this was developed, it was inspired really during the war. So there were certain emotional aspects that were enhanced by processing. And this never, it was beautifully documented, the score, all the instructions, how to, you know, do the live electronics, but it never saw the light of day. One, possibly because she was a woman and there were no openings in the classical world for women composers.
Yeah.
It's that simple. But I just did a piece in Amsterdam with the Metropole Orchestra, which is a classical and jazz orchestra. This is what it takes. Because, you know, I've worked with classical orchestras, and of course, things are changing. The musicians are more relaxed. They're not as threatened.
Yes, I see what you mean.
But it was just such a joy to work with this orchestra because, you know, it was a real romance. It was a real partnership. I had my buchla on the stage. I was processing some of the instruments spatially so that they could move with me. And then, you know, we integrated the buchla scenes, you know, the various musical sections, and it worked very well. But now can I get this released? Is there a contemporary music label that wants to release in quadraphonic something that is not normal? Yes. So I think, you know, in the worst case, I'll release it. But there is, you know, I just worked with a composer from England, and he was commissioned to do a score for the San Francisco Ballet, and he integrated Sam Shepard.
Oh, Sam Shepard. Yeah,
yeah, the name. Yeah. It's starting to happen. You know, what it is, it requires a simple setup of speakers. It's electronic. It comes out of speakers. So then you need to integrate the orchestra with that element. And, you know, it took me several years to figure out how to do that. But anyway, it's doable. And it's more, it's starting to happen.
Took a while, though.
It took a long time, yeah.
Yes.
And I've been alive for a lot of that time.
Yes.
So I've watched it.
You know, and contributed to, to at least the moment for that time. It seems to me, again, that electronic music has, well, particularly, say, what is considered the most or the more commercial side of electronic music. It seems to me that it doesn't have exploited the specialization of sound much as it could have, and has stayed within the stereo, even sometimes more, because there's a lot of talking about mono compatibility, because the way that we listen to music nowadays with phones, it's mostly a mono signal really that comes out. So much of the music that's been produced in recent years has to take into account the way that people consume music, and the way people consume music has been restricted to
their position, please.
Yeah.
Stereo.
Yes. Which is, again, like you said, it's a bit of a shame, because that's where electronic music can introduce an element of a compositional element to it that classical music not has had from time to time, but not always have considered as part of its core sense of composition.
Well, electronic music is the only one that naturally wants to move. You know, it doesn't have a physical place. And so motion is, and space, and the creation of space is a natural job for that to do. You know, space is not just a movement, but it's also moving the sound close and far away. So we have processing that allows us to create imaginary spaces, you know, reverb. But nowadays we have so many processes that we can apply to the sound. It's very rich in terms of the experience of the spatial sound, the immersion in the space. Yes, it's very interesting that the big contributor now to this possibility is actually the film world.
Indeed.
And when I, you know, I did a film in 1980, and Hollywood was way beyond. It really was monophonic back then. Mm-hmm. They didn't even have stereo. It was shocking. Now they're ahead. They jumped ahead. They are 5-1, mm-hmm. 7-1. What this means is that people have the infrastructure now in their home theaters or in their bedrooms or wherever they consume media, that they have the spatial setup. And of course, it's a lot easier now because the speakers are smaller and higher quality, and they can communicate by Bluetooth. And, you know, it's very simple, really, to get this infrastructure for the sound. But, and now we're starting distribution. You know, we have Atmos stepping in and saying, you know, we are the conduit for delivering this sound. The only thing is, an old problem, because quad, you know, came in the 70s as a consumer possibility, but it didn't work. Why? Because there was no content. So how do you, you know, in film, they have an excuse. The car is moving from here to here, the bullet comes from back there, you know, and they use it to define, you know, the action, but it's not musical. What the Buchla does is it creates spatial movement that is musical.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's an ideal medium for fulfilling the promise. The immersive sound.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, let's hope that we make it, because we still have a content problem. Yeah, they don't know how to use it. And it's, okay, so here's one of the distinctions, is that a lot of Atmos and a lot of sound is post-production. So they have the sound, and then they're going to map it into some kind of space.
Yes.
With the Buchla, it is not post-production. The space is created in the moment of performing. That's a big distinction.
It is.
Yeah.
The other thing that really fascinated me when we were talking about the Buchla and electronic music instruments in general, I guess, is that you felt that they were somehow misrepresented, in the sense that they were more like a timbre curiosity rather than being considered as sound that can move, in the sense that it can also transform itself over time.
Yes. Yes. What happened is when they put the keyboard on the Moog, that was the end. Because, you know, they were marketing it to a public who didn't have any reference point for what this new machine was. And they put the keyboard on, and then they made a sound, and they said, oh, look, it can sound, it's a musical instrument, it can sound like a flute, it can sound like a string. And that froze the consciousness of what could be done for a generation, two generations.
Yeah.
People thought it was about the sound, and the word synthesizer became, you know, I never used it. Don Buchla never talked about a synthesizer,
mm-hmm.
because that implied mimicking, mm-hmm. synthesizing a sound, making a sound that already existed, remaking it. And that wasn't it. And then we had a long period of sampling where you could take an orchestra or anything you wanted and make a sample of it and then incorporate that. The problem with that is that, to my ear anyway, it's dead. It's, mm-hmm. I say samples are dead on arrival because they don't have life in them. They're not transforming. They're not moving. So the essence of electronic music, analog module, or electronic music instruments is that the sound is morphing. Well, it's organic. It's alive. It is shaping, and there's no there there. And I think in a performance, what people enjoy is being able to follow this transformation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you start in one place, and movement by movement, it becomes something else. And you follow that, and it's satisfying, mm-hmm. that transformational process. And that's one of the compositional, you know, what is composition? Composition is the architecture, and it's based on, you know, whatever system we're using. When in the classical world, it was very much based on harmony. And you know, you used harmony in these platforms to create excitement and the development. And, you know, I think that at least the way I use my electronic composition, it's very much in the contrapuntal world because of the sequences.
Mm-hmm.
So my building blocks are sequences. It's mm-hmm. counterpoint. And then it's transformational. How do you transform those given materials
mm-hmm.
into something that engages you in the experience of moving through a composition?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I know that sounds very vague, but...
Yeah. I spoken to me at least. speaking of writing music, have you ever thought of committing your electronic music practice to paper somehow, so to make it available to others in the future to study and maybe build on?
Well, oddly enough, in 1976, I got a grant from the National Endowment, and they required that I document something. So I wrote a 40-page paper about how to play the bugla. And that is available. It's called Report to National Endowment. You know, it's still a good key to discover my practice and how I develop techniques for the instrument. And it can be abstracted. You know, you don't have to have a bugla, because after all these years, the definition of an analog modular musical instrument has distilled. And we have a lot of consistent, nothing is the same, mm-hmm. you know, but you have oscillators, filters, mm-hmm. envelope generators. And, you know, if you go out and get a module, they're all different, but they're functionally in these consistent categories. So it does translate. It's not literally, I'm not going to write something where, but there are people who have done it.
Mm-hmm. That's why I was asking.
Yeah, there's one guy who took that paper and he reproduced it in a computer form. So he can do all the sequences that I did and all the techniques that I did. So yes, it is translatable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You mentioned oscillators. At the Museum of Musical Instruments here in Milan, there are two oscillators that belonged to one of the biggest electronic music workshops we had in Europe, the Studio di Fonologia della RAI Milan, which used to produce music for the new national broadcast company in Italy, RAI. So I'm curious, how do you feel about seeing some of the instruments that you were familiar with or you either played on or performed on now being in a museum beneath a glass?
Isn't it wonderful? It's so wonderful. Yeah, I mean, you know, that's so strange because my early bugla was supposed to be in a museum. I was approached by a museum and I donated it, I thought, to a museum.
And then
the person who represented himself as the museum representative just took the instrument and sold it. Yeah, too. So there are a lot of, you know, sad, bad behavior in this field. Yeah. And half of it was stolen. That was another story. But no, it's wonderful. There are wonderful museums now that show this evolution of the instruments, but it's a complex evolution and not easily understood. And I feel fortunate, really, that my life has paralleled a lot of this evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm grateful for just being alive today. to be able to, you know, watch it happen. Mm-hmm. And I think what's happening now is that we've rediscovered those earlier days, mm-hmm. right? The kids said, we don't want digital. We're tired of, you know, using the mouse and menus.
Mm-hmm.
And they went back to analog.
Physical approach.
Physical approach. And that's very important. And that's really where we need to go, because the first time it didn't work. It was aborted. I mean, it was all wonderful, but we lost something. We did something. We had wonderful instruments that could record in studios and play sounds on keyboards, but we didn't have the vision of the performable voltage control instrument that really is a compositional instrument. You know, composition, if you look at it, you know, composers have always been looking for, you know, methods.
Mm-hmm.
Berio with his little, you know, modules of sound and taking materials and collapsing them and expanding them and transposing them and putting them backwards and mm-hmm. forwards. And these are ways of transforming the raw materials that we're dealing with. And there is a, this instrument is a tool for composition, because we can take your materials and interact with them in meaningful compositional ways. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. When you started making music, electronic music specifically, were you listening to any other electronic musicians as you were developing your own explorations of the Brooklyn and what it meant for you as a musician and performer?
Well, my very first recording was Voices of Packaged Souls. And I did that at a radio station, and I used Musique Concrète in it, mm-hmm. because that was what was available. And Musique Concrète was the precursor mm-hmm. to a lot of this, you know, sonic work. So I was aware of that, and I was aware of, you know, the European composers. There wasn't that much. In the United States, there was the RCA, you know, with the Milton Babbitt.
I remember at some point, I think you met Vladimir Sucheski.
Hi. Yes. Oh, yes, he came to one of my concerts, and he is really the reason why I got that grant.
The one you mentioned before.
Yeah. So, yes, he was wonderful. And then I got my first record deal with Ilhan Nimaroglu. Now, I didn't know if he was involved in electronic music. Yeah. But, you know, he was wonderful, and I only learned, you know, recently, actually, of his compositions.
Mm-hmm.
So did I know about other people? You know, I was in my own world because I was, you know, I had my Buchla and I was living with the Buchla. I would say it was a very internalized evolution. But yeah, I mean, I studied at Stanford. Max Matthews, the father of computer music, mm-hmm. was there. John Chowning, who came up with FM and licensed it to Yamaha, you know, Stanford. Artificial Intelligence Laboratory. It was just starting mm-hmm. then. Our computers were the size of, you know, trains. So, yeah, it was an interesting time.
You mentioned before Daphne Oram.
Yes. I didn't know about her. See, we didn't know about each other.
Mm-hmm.
There was no communication. It's not like today where everything is instantly out in the, you know, available world. What did I know about? I knew about Tangerine Dream.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw that they had success in Europe. And then there was Tomita in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking for a record deal, because in those days you couldn't record without one. And so I went to Europe mm-hmm. and I made the rounds, you know, of all the record labels. And I did not get a record deal. And then I went to Japan.
Did you come to Italy as well?
Yes. I went to every place. Wow. Yeah, every place.
Can you mention any labels that you released from the time? Well, if you do remember.
Well, no. The one, there were some that gave me good response. And it's all in my archive, by the way. Mm-hmm. You know, I do have these boxes of stuff that document.
I want to go back to this, because we are sitting in an archive here.
Okay.
The Kimberly Record, of course. So
yeah.
Recording this. So
yeah. The information is there, but I can name a couple of labels from them because there was one that I probably could have gotten a deal with, but
Gordy had a label actually.
Oh, did it? Okay.
Yes. They were more focused on pop music at the time. Folk and pop music and singer-songwriters after many years, of course, specializing
yes.
in classical music.
Yeah.
That was the time. But
it didn't fit in. You know, electronic music, it wasn't classical. It wasn't not, you know, classical.
Yeah.
You know, there was no category.
There was no category. You mentioned your archive, and there was one interview when you said that when you went to look through it for Edible Tales and the Skippers, who seem to be very persistent. Luckily, I would say, for us enjoying your music now. You said that you found a bit depressing to go through your archive. So I wanted to see if you wanted to talk about this. Why did you find depressing to look through those boxes? Because archives can be sometimes depressing, I guess, because it's old memories. It's stuff that is not useful somehow anymore, I guess. But they can also be a source of inspirations for some.
I think it actually gave me a great sense of relief. Because when you're on the journey, when you're always looking for the thing that you need to move forward, and you depend, you know, I became very independent because I couldn't find a lot of support outside, you know, in an industry. And so I just shifted gears and started my own record label, made my own recordings, etc. And of course, by the way, Seven Waves was written out. My first, you know, official album, Seven Waves. By the time I got in a position to record, I had already, you know, my Google had already failed. Again, so I had half of it. And my approach became more a synthesis of classical and electronic. So it was scored, and it was realized in a studio. It wasn't a live performance, although a lot of the tracks were more, you know, live. That is just a matter of the evolution. You know, these, when you're in technology, nothing stays the same. Every day you wake up and it's different. Yeah. And that's the stimulation and part of the joy of being in it. It was like, okay, what's new today? I love being there. But now, yeah, when I looked at my archive, I was happy to have been done with a lot of the struggles that were there. And it's wonderful to get older and to be in a, you know, in a vantage point of seeing it's done now. It's done. And my job now really is just to talk to you.
Thank you.
I'm good.
Yeah. Talking about struggles, of course, women in many fields, including classical music and electronic music, they had to face many closed doors, many preconceptions. Are we doing any better now, you think, in archiving, in promoting, in discovering, researching the music that has been done and the music that is now done by women?
It's a good start. And it had to be done consciously. Mm-hmm. It had to be a goal, really, because on its own, you know, everybody, I think, thinks that these things, if they're meant to happen, will just happen. And what we realized was that because the mechanics of the, you know, system were so inoperable, we had to go in and physically open some doors consciously. And that's created, you know, a more critical mass of women. I was teaching at Berklee College of Music as a guest, you know, a couple of times a year. And when I started there, they were saying, well, why aren't there any women? We can't find any women. We don't, there are no women. And I'm sitting there in this room with 18 men. And I said, well, look at who's in control here. I said, you know, women are outnumbered and they don't feel safe here. And so they said, oh, well, maybe we should alter this ratio. And they they suddenly realized it wasn't just going to happen. And so they made it happen. Mm-hmm. And now the head of the department is female. The women are comfortable. And it's starting to, it's really taken hold. You know, it's, I'm very happy about what's happened there.
The other thing that really struck me when we were talking about electronic music is that you wanted to be perceived as, or you wanted to feel sensual in a sense, which for many would sound counterintuitive because electronic music is often seen as cold and very lab-like in a sense.
Yeah.
So I wanted to see if you wanted to comment a little bit on this.
Yes, I mean, without referencing what it is to somebody else, to me, it was sensual. And if you look at it, if you can just take that angle, you see that it is warm. The machine is on. Mm-hmm. It's alive. Mm-hmm. It's talking to you. It's a partner. It's really a relationship with the machine. It is comforting because the rhythm is dependable. It can be a machine, but that doesn't mean that it has to drive you crazy with this repetition. It can be played very slowly. So it can sustain a long trajectory of sound. And subconsciously, I always felt, you know, seven waves, it was really just one long piece, right, with the waves connecting it. And people think that I sampled the ocean. I didn't sample the ocean. That's the Buqua. You know, it can make waves. So I think that it is comforting. My goal was to make something safe, a safe space to be in, some place where you could completely relax.
Mm-hmm.
And the machine gave me the ability to do that.
One last question.
Yeah.
Talking about machines being partners, now there is a lot of talk about machines actually taking over and being the partner that is in charge, rather than being a collaborative effort.
Right.
How do you feel about this perception that now machines could be the masters?
I mean, there will always be an opening for human creativity. I don't think we need to be threatened. We're not going to say, well, I guess I should stop creating. Because the machine is better than I am. Mm-hmm. No, so yeah, it's a parallel universe. It is interesting. Maybe we can even learn from it. Mm-hmm. Maybe it can step us forward a little bit more, mm-hmm. or give us ideas. Mm-hmm. I just think that human creativity exists on so many levels. So you have the top of the pyramid, you have Puccini, mm-hmm. Verdi. But in order to appreciate Puccini and Verdi, you need a lot of people who know how to play the instruments, know how to, you know, have to be conversant in the language. And that creates the listening. So there are two sides to the whole thing. I don't feel threatened by art. When I was at Stanford in the 60s, they were making something called the Banal Tune Generator. So the idea was that you could make the machine generate melodies and all that would be great. Yes, it's wonderful, and it helps us to understand our own thought process. So I don't feel threatened. But I do think that it is a call to really regulate. You know, you were talking about recording and copyright and publishing. And that whole business system is the real foundation for creativity. And we need that now in artificial intelligence, because what we're doing is we're recycling human creativity that's already happened. Yeah. We're taking that. Without that being fed into the machine, there's nothing there. But we need to, and we can, keep track of that. You know, the systems for tracking with computers now are infinite. Nothing has to get lost. You can really, I mean, you know, you get your royalty statements nowadays and it's like 5,000 little tiny things from all over the, you know. So they can really account for where stuff is coming from, mm-hmm. where it's gone. And so, you know, maybe it's just an ancillary form of royalty.
Suzanne Chani, it's been such a pleasure speaking to you today.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Francesco, grazie.
Grazie.